Hey, folks, you're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. You do not know what you're missing. In fact, I'm not even sure what you're missing because I'm not sure what we gave you for free this week, but we've got two-thirds of the show waiting for you for just pennies a day. That's right. Go over to ROFpodcast.com. Sign up for the member show. You'll get more content. You'll get it commercial-free, and you will keep this show alive. If you enjoy what you've been listening to week in, week out, support the program. Get more of that great content. We've got great interviews behind the tiny, 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 tiny paywall. ROFpodcast.com. Thanks so much for listening. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, America's lawyer, Mike Papantonio, will be joining us to discuss his new legal thriller, Law and Addiction. We'll discuss some of the attorney generals that are stepping up to solve the opioid crisis. Investigative journalist David Dane will be here to talk about a secret vote that could wipe away consumer rights. Heather Digby Parton from Salon will join me to analyze all the big news stories of the week. And Ian Millhiser from Think Progress will tell us what is the most important question facing the winner of the Democratic primaries. Hey, if you're new to the show, you can find the free one-hour podcast of Ring of Fire Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever podcasts are found. There's also a member show, and you can support Ring of Fire by becoming a member and getting our three-hour radio show commercial free with access to all of our archives over the last decade. You can go to ROFpodcast.com to sign up. Do it right now. Here to run down the biggest stories of the week, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her from her blog, Hullabaloo, Digby. So, Heather, this week we have moved into a different era, it seems to me, in terms of the question of impeachment. And there's been a couple of measures of it. Part of it is, it seems to me, that some people have become more adamant. But a big part of it is, it seems, that the Trump administration is actively courting this. If they're not, it's very peculiar behavior because they are now not only taking the case of impeachment from one involving actions of the president that are outlined, frankly, in the Mueller report, even though there's no indictments, further indictments, not just in terms of obstruction, but I think, frankly, if people read it, they'll find plenty of reason to impeach the president if he can't, despite the fact that he can't be charged with a specific criminal conspiracy. But also because of the sort of subsequent obstruction on multiple fronts that have nothing to do with the Mueller investigation, things like the taxes, things like this and that. But just generally speaking, so the facts on the ground have changed and the political facts have changed.
I think that's right. And it does seem as though they're courting impeachment. But if they are, they're very, very stupid. And they are very stupid. But I actually think, to me, this looks like a typical Trump terrible negotiation. I mean, for all of his reputation for being a great negotiator, he is a terrible negotiator, and we've seen that over and over again. And I think in this case, he's playing chicken, and he thinks that, you know, by listening to Pelosi and by looking back at the Clinton impeachment and having people probably, you know, whispering this stuff in his ear as well, that, you know, he can push the Democrats off of impeachment by pretending that he wants it. In other words, this idea of him goading them into it because, you know, he really feels like this is going to be a big winner for him is actually a bluff. And so, I mean, that's what I think. I mean, I don't know. Maybe he is that stupid that he wants an impeachment. I mean, no president should ever want an impeachment. It's ridiculous. I mean, I'm sure Bill Clinton, who came out ahead, although he started out way ahead, I bet looking back on it, I don't think he would say, yeah, that was really great. I'm sure glad that happened. I mean, that's just not something that any president should ever want. It's the nuclear option on his presidency.
Well, all right, wait a second. I mean, let's talk about that, because there's a couple of sides to this question, right? I mean, of impeachment. There's the political question, and there's two sides of that political question, and we'll get to that in a moment. And then there's just sort of the, you know, broader import of impeachment. But it seems to me, from the perspective of Donald Trump anyways, that and his advisors, that impeachment, that they could rationally believe, I think they would be wrong in this case, but it's not inconceivable to me that they could rationally believe that it would benefit them insofar as there is no political agenda of the Trump administration. They don't have one outside of probably, you know, what they're doing on the immigration front, what they're doing on the sort of the whitening of America. They don't have one, certainly not one that involves Congress in any way. Their fans, you know, their supporters don't seem to care about one. And so this is a way of avoiding that. And they look at those numbers. You're right. Bill Clinton started, more popular than Donald Trump. But it added to Clinton's popularity. People forget this is a guy who won 45% of the vote the first time he got elected. You know, he was helped to a large extent by third party running. In 92, anyways, it was Ross Perot. He gained more, obviously, going into his second term. But he left the office as popular as he had ever been because of impeachment. And, you know, it didn't. So from that perspective, that very narrow perspective, I could see people saying to Trump, like, look, you know how you've been talking about obstruction? Well, now they're really obstructing you. I mean, I could see it being rational from his perspective. But Nancy Pelosi, up until this week, and I want to talk about what I think is a subtle shift that took place midweek, has been saying, you know, Trump is goading us into impeachment and we're not going to go there. It may be the case that Trump is goading the Democrats into impeachment, but just because Trump is, that doesn't mean that Trump is right, right? Like, you know, it's not like Donald Trump has been brilliant, like you say, horrible negotiator, not necessarily very good at strategy. He won an election. It was a fluke. There was about 12 different reasons why he did. Pretty good at tactics in terms of dominating the news, but that's not the same as being able to withstand a sort of relentless, ongoing, all-encompassing campaign that starts to air all his dirty laundry. Like, Donald Trump could be trying to convince the Democrats to impeach him, and he could also be horribly, horribly wrong about the intelligence of doing so.
He is horribly wrong. I mean, I look back at the Clinton impeachment, and, you know, I don't want to belabor it, but, you know, that interpretation that he really benefited from it, he did in the polling. You know, he was on his way out, by the way. I mean, he was in his second term. I mean, there was no chance that he was going to be reelected. It was a different situation in that regard. But the truth is that Clinton was already quite popular, and he had already been under relentless investigation for a dozen different things over the course of his two terms at that point. People saw what that particular impeachment process with the Monica Lewinsky scandal as being trivial, and it had, you know, it right. had no, it wasn't a high, it was clearly not a high crime and misdemeanor. That is not the case here. I mean, we are talking about, and this obstruction that is in the Mueller report, if anybody cares to read it, is really obvious. This guy, all those prosecutors, I don't know, it's close to 1,000 now who've signed that document saying that if they were prosecuting this case, they would prosecute. They have believe there is more than enough evidence to prosecute Donald Trump for obstruction of justice, and he would be prosecuted. It's really obvious. And the collusion side of it, you know, Mueller, there's a whole lot of stuff. And in fact, that's something that happened this week we can talk about, that there's a whole lot of stuff that didn't make it into the Mueller report. About the, you know, Russia interference and the sabotage of Clinton's campaign and what the Trump people did, a lot of that under, you know, was classified, redacted, and there's a whole investigation that continues that had that Mueller did not put into his report. So, you know, that whole part of it is, I mean, this is a, just to make a long story short, this is just a much, much, much more serious situation than
right.
the one that confronted Clinton in 1998, and the
right.
American people understand that.
I think
worked throughout. As you know, he worked with the Congress, he worked with
right.
anybody, he passed legislation, he would meet with Newt Gingrich, and they would have a friendly conversation. I mean, it was weird, but he did it, and people gave him credit for that, for being able to be the president and be, you know, it made him look
and
tough.
Compartmentalized.
It really did.
Yeah, all right. Well, we got to take a break. We're going to take a break. When we come back, let's talk a little bit more about that difference. And also, there's another half of the equation. It's not just about how this impacts Donald Trump. It's also how it impacts the Democrats. We got to
exactly.
take a quick break. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back with Digby. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, when we broke, we were talking about this question of impeachment. We were basically talking about it from the perspective first, because there's a lot of different ways to look at this. Donald Trump, it appears, to be goading the Democrats into impeaching him by, you know, not performing, not just all the things he's done that are problematic as president, but preventing Congress from performing its oversight. And from Trump's perspective, he may very well be goading the Democrats into it. He may think it might be to his advantage. You've pointed out a number of things that make the analogy to Bill Clinton inoperative, ranging from the fact that Clinton was already somewhat popular, ranging from the fact that Clinton, the issues with impeachment were already very trivial, ranging from Clinton being able to work contemporaneously with Republicans during that because he's not, he didn't have the emotional maturity of a six-year-old, and so wasn't going to go scream to high heaven about it constantly. But the other thing is that I think, you know, that Nancy Pelosi up till now, and we could get to why I say now, has not been taking into account is there was no cost associated for Republicans at that time. We're talking about 1996, 97, 98, with not attempting to impeach, or I should say impeaching Clinton. And I should make it clear, we're talking about this with full knowledge that the Senate it would not convict. Maybe they would, but I think you have to assume, if you're going to assume anything, that they won't. There's a real cost, it seems to me, for Democrats to not impeach Donald Trump, or at the very least, start the process. I mean, let's talk about that for a moment.
Well, I agree with you completely. First of all, let's look at the myth that the Republicans paid for their impeachment of Clinton. They really didn't. They lost some seats in the 98 election, but they didn't lose their majority. And in 2000, we all know what happened. I mean, George W. Bush became president. So that, you know, the idea that they're sitting around worried that, oh, you know, golly, you know, we don't want that to happen to us is kind of ridiculous. And it's overblown that there was a great price to be paid by the Republicans.
I would say that even underestimates the advantages that Republicans got, because
True.
Democrats lost a lot of elections in states and, you know, the more local elections. Al Gore elevated Joe Lieberman to the heights, you know, made him vice presidential nominee because he was the big scold in the Senate of Bill Clinton during the impeachment process. And Joe Lieberman went on to basically, I mean, you know, you could blame Joe Lieberman right now for why we don't have a Medicare buy-in at age 55, for gosh sakes. I mean, if there would have been somebody else in there, you know, at that time, a non-Joe Lieberman type, we would be much better off. And Joe Lieberman was elevated because of impeachment. So there's a lot of benefits that accrued to the Republicans, and there was no downside to not doing it.
Exactly. And, you know, I mean, look, George W. Bush's motto when he ran in 2000 was, I'm going to restore honor and dignity to the White House. I mean, and this ushered in a new sort of, you know, tidal wave of moralizing. And you remember when Republicans used to care about that? And they, you know, that everything was about religion and, you know, and that, you know, that gave all this power to the far right that they used very effectively during the first decade of the new century and under George W. Bush. This is a myth that the Democrats have something to fear. And as you point out, it's not just that they don't have anything to fear. It's that they do have something to fear from their own base. Democrats are not in a mood for this idea of playing it safe. And let's all, you know, I mean, Pelosi's been out there. She and her people have been out there talking, well, you know, in fact, one of them, the deputy vice chair of the Democratic caucus, went on TV and said that all this talk about oversight and impeachment was a distraction from what people really care about, you know. And this, I just, that enrages me, because I think people do care about their country. I think they care about the fact that we have, basically a criminal in the White House, and they want this stuff aired out. And I don't think I'm alone in that. When you hear even Joe Biden's crowd, the biggest cheer he gets on there is when he says, you know, we have got to stop Donald Trump. Now, I agree, and we don't have to even debate this, that Biden's probably the last one to be, you know, looked to for leadership on this. But nonetheless, even he gets that kind of response from audiences. So, you know, yes, people care about issues and they care about their personal lives, but they also care about the country. And I think it's really insulting to say that Democrats are not, you know, desperately concerned with what's going on in Washington with Donald Trump and the crimes that he's committed.
I agree with you. And this has been, you know, to the extent that Democrats do, they do so despite the fact that the leadership of their party, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, have been poo-pooing it for months and months and months.
Exactly.
And so, all right. But with that said, I want to take a break. I want you to join me in the next hour if you can, because I think there has been a bit of a change in the rhetoric that Nancy Pelosi has been using, which suggests to me that we're on to Plan B, that the facts on the ground and the political pressure has caught up to her position, and we're about to see a change. And I think part of it was also a function of what we saw this week with Steve Mnuchin, with Ben Carson, and with Bill Barr. We got to take a break. We'll be back with more Ring of Fire. Digby will join me in the next hour. Coming up, America's lawyer, Mike Papantonio, is going to be here to discuss his new legal thriller, Law and Addiction. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he's been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. In the late 1990s, pharmaceutical companies reassured the medical community that patients would not become addicted to opioid pain relievers, and healthcare providers began to prescribe them at greater rates. The result led to over 47,000 deaths. Joining me to discuss how this crisis was the inspiration for his latest legal thriller and which attorney generals are having an impact on solving the problem, Ring of Fire Radio co-founder and attorney, Mike Papantonio. So, Pap, let's just start where we have the most, I think, and you tell me, because you have a much better sense of this, we have the most aggressive addressing of the opioid problem, at least in terms of holding people to account in Massachusetts. Is that right?
Yeah, I think Maura Healey is such a courageous attorney general. Here's some good news, though. You now have an attorney general in Nevada. His name is Aaron Ford. You know, he is no nonsense. He's not all about let's compromise this. His position seems to be, you know what, you dumped this stuff on us. You knew what you were doing. We're having to pay for it. You need to pay us back. But both him and Maura Healey take the attitude, I call it externalizing cost. And if what I mean by that, Sam, if I were to describe to you a situation where a corporation came into your backyard and they dumped gazillion gallons of toxins into your river and drinking water. And what they did is they did that so they could make more profit. They could take all those costs, ship them over to taxpayers to clean up, externalize all the health risks to taxpayers, externalize all the infrastructure problems to taxpayers to clean up, and then go home and keep all the profits. That's what the drug industry has done here. That's what the opioid manufacturers and distributors have done. They've shipped this all for taxpayers to take care of. And Maura Healey is very angry about it. Aaron Ford in Nevada, you're going to see this. I mean, we're going to be handling that case out. Matter of fact, I'll be trying that case with Robert Eglett out there, who's a superb trial lawyer. But it'll be Troy Rafferty, myself, and Eglett that are doing that, along with a great team of trial lawyers. And I think it's very possible it could be the first case to actually start trial in America. But Maura Healey is a great American hero. I got to tell you, I just really am so proud to see an attorney general step up. Sam, do you remember, you know, in the book, I wrote a book, it's called Law and Addiction.
Right.
And in that book, I talk about, it's a fiction, but I use real facts all through the book. One real fact was where you had attorney generals about 8 or 9 years ago that all got together and settled the entire opium, opiate program across America, 150 people a day dying. They knew that, and they settled, these attorney generals settled for $19 million. And then they declared victory, Sam. They got up the next day and said, we've really done a great job for American consumers. We've solved the opioid crisis. Then they ran for governor. So most attorney generals, that's why they call it the AG. It's almost governor. And so you've got that happening all over the country. You've got attorney generals, just all over the country that are saying, you know, we don't have the courage. We don't have I don't know what it is. How do you not take on these folks on behalf of your consumers? But Maura Healey, she is. Aaron Ford, he is. And you're going to see some real, these people are going to run into some brick walls where it comes to trying to soft pedal this with these attorney generals, because it's deplorable what happened. They helped create the opioid crisis by not doing their job all the way back then.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about the context of that crisis. And of course, in Law and Addiction, you start with a law student who loses his brother to an opioid overdose. And coming from West Virginia, which in many respects was, you know, ground zero for this, or at the very least was one of the greatest illustrations of the problem. But I read that in 2017, we had the highest number of overdoses that we've had from this. And that's the thing that I think people don't understand. And I think your point about the attorney generals signing off for a couple million dollars, several million dollars, as if the problem was over. This is a problem that the ripples of, I mean, even, you know, even though to some extent we have corrected the overprescribing that was happening, the implications of this ripple, and that's the interesting thing about the policy answers we're seeing and about these court cases that you're involved in, it seems to me that in terms of like the remedies, because you have people who are dying years out mm-hmm. from the initial sort of, I guess, act, which was yeah. the malignant act. Like, just explain that dynamic to us and then how this implicates what kind of damages or what kind of policies one would seek to redress this issue.
Okay, well, first of all, let me spend another minute on that. You understand the attorney general in West Virginia, one of the states that were hit the hardest, settled with one of the worst players for $25 million. And then come to find out, oh, by the way, his wife had worked for the industry. So, I mean, you know, it's time and time with this ugly story where we've seen political officials like this attorney general in West Virginia who just are nothing but an arm of the industry. I mean, they're not real. He's not really an attorney general. I mean, he has that title of attorney general. He's not really an attorney general. I mean, he's working for the industry. So that was happening all over the country for many, many years because they were pumping so much money into these various races and making all kinds of promises. So, okay, where that left us was the solution is that a city or a county, let's take Nevada, for example, because, again, that's where I'll be going to trial. In Nevada, you had a situation where the EMTs, the cost for just EMTs in about just one county there went up like the entire infrastructure cost to address the problem in one year was $300 million. Okay. So who's going to pay for that? Does a taxpayer in Clark County pay for that? I mean, they got to pay for that. Or do the people who took all the money home, shouldn't they pay for that? But we're so upside down in the way we look at this. In Law and Addiction, in that book, again, it's a fiction, but it's all based on what I'm doing every single day. I took the depositions in that case, not all of them, but I took a lot of them. I heard the stories firsthand from the distributors and the manufacturers, and I saw it firsthand. I handled the distributors. I didn't handle the manufacturers because I think the manufacturers are only one part of the story. But the distributors are the people who were right there, I mean, right doing business every day in the cities all across America. They're the people that would see people lined up around these pill mills. They had salespeople right in the town. And that salesperson would drive by these pill mills and see people at 8 o'clock in the morning standing outside in their pajamas waiting to get their drugs for the day. The salespeople saw that. This was no surprise to them. They saw exactly what was happening. So the solution, the only solution is you've got to make them pay back the taxpayers. That's the first step. And then the second step is they've got to pay for years and years of rehab. Here's the problem, Sam. This is a very different kind of addiction. It's the equivalent of heroin addiction. The dopamine levels in the brain change so dramatically. The receptors in the brain are so affected by opium. And that's all this is. It's opium. I mean, we want to call it Oxycontin and opiates. It's opium. It's the same opium that almost decimated the entire continent of China, you know, just a couple thousand years ago. So what ends up happening is in the United States, we now have to rehab people that their brain on the dopamine, on the significant changes of dopamine in the brain are so dramatic that it takes 3 years for those dopamine levels to even return to normal, wow, to where you can even rehabilitate them.
All right. Well, Pap, let's take a break here. When we come back, I just want to go through this because it, you know, the dynamic that you're talking is basically where you started with this notion of a system that privatized the profits, socialized the costs, laid them off not just onto the customers, theoretically the patients really, and society at large, and those people who are tasked to protect the taxpayer and society at large basically were asleep at the wheel, short of a couple of attorney generals around the country. We will talk about that. We will talk about those costs that are associated with it and just how large essentially the cost this will be to society. And I don't mean just has been, but will be in the future. We got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Seder. I'm talking to Mike Papantonio. We'll be right back. Ring of Fire Radio. We are back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. Right now, I'm talking with America's lawyer, Mike Papantonio, about his new legal thriller inspired by the real-life opioid crisis, Law and Addiction. So, Pap, in the last segment, you were giving us a little bit of background. Of course, you are involved in cases dealing with the distributors of so-called OxyContin. You say it's essentially opium. And that's ultimately what we came to understand, that the whole premise of this stuff was that it was some type of new non-addictive version of opium. And it turned out to be an addictive version of opium, like all opium. And, you write about this in Law and Addiction. But they thought, we have a new way of packaging in this. They ended up convincing doctors. Some instances they didn't need much convincing. Some, in many, they were just assuming that they were getting the straight information that these things could be prescribed to people who, instead of it being originally for people who have survived cancer or going through something acutely painful in a short period of time, they started to prescribe it for chronic pain. And there are three elements to this. There's the producer of the drugs who told their story. There are the patient-facing distributors. That would be the doctors who were relying on material they get. And then there's the distributors. And this is what your cases center around, the responsibility to distributors. And my understanding is part of this responsibility is not just a general ethical responsibility to society, but they have a statutory obligation to record when they see bumps.
Yeah. You hit the heart of the case. Look, in exchange for these distributors being able to do their job, the government says there's some things you must do. Okay. One thing you must do is you have a responsibility to where if you see somebody ordering levels that are well beyond what they should be for that locality, you need to report them. Okay. Almost nobody reported like they were supposed to. They broke the law in that regard. They didn't report. That's the only thing they had to do. And then the second thing was, once you see it and you report it, you have a duty to try to make it right. You can't just sit there and say, oh, gee whiz, this little town, great example, Kermit. How about this? Kermit, West Virginia. Population 400 people. They were selling 6 million pills in Kermit, West Virginia every single year. In my book, Law and Addiction, I talk about how that occurred. Why did that happen in Kermit, West Virginia? 400 people cannot use 6 million narcotics, right? So that becomes part of the distribution plan, what we call the glut. The glut starts, you've heard of the Oxy Express, I think, probably. And the Oxy Express starts in Miami, goes all up this eastern seaboard, and then it started turning out west to Nevada and California. And that could only operate, you understand, it could only operate if there were enough narcotics out there. If there was enough opium narcotic out there, that's the only way it could operate. these companies understood that they were putting well more than enough to keep the Oxy Express alive and keep all of this diversion, this criminal activity with the drugs, keeping that moving. So to say, well, gee, let me make a couple assumptions here, Sam. Let's say the first year that they came out with these narcotic opiums, let's say that the first year that they didn't know how bad it was going to be. So let's give them the first year. Second year, maybe, well, we just didn't know it was going to be this, you know, abused. The third year, we didn't know it was going to turn into criminal activity. By the third year, they absolutely knew. They knew exactly what was happening with the drugs. The DEA told them it was a problem. The General Accounting Office does a great report talking about how the FDA had to tell some of the folks that were distributing this that you're not telling the truth. You're not telling the truth about this being non-addictive. They were actually making that up, telling doctors it's non-addictive. And the worst part of it, the way they were doing it was by phonying up literature. They would go to a university and they would write a report. They would write a piece of literature, ask some scientist who's only making $150,000 a year. In his mind, that's not enough. So they pay him another $200. He signs his name to it to give it credibility. They go then tell doctors, hey, look, we have this, we got this literature right here. It says that this stuff won't be addictive. So then they start teaching that in medical school. And this whole myth goes on and on and on. This didn't happen by mistake, Sam. This happened by design. And you can't pinpoint any one thing or one event that took place. It was a culmination of all of this effort by the pharma industry that was selling narcotic opium. They all, you know, if you take a look at the conduct, it all converges. It all right. Just fits together.
Well, I mean, Pap, isn't it the case that a couple of years ago the distributors were actually looking to change the law and try and get it to be retroactive because the statutes require the distributor to set a baseline and to be to have the data that sets a baseline so they can measure that a spike. I mean, to a layperson, it sounds completely obvious that 400 people should not be getting 6 million opioid pills. I mean, you don't need to have reams of data and some type of algorithmic, but
no, you don't.
They wanted to change the law.
Yeah, what you're talking about is Arcos data. Okay, our firm put together what they call the Arcos data. It's centrally reporting what's going on. They didn't even need Arcos data. All they needed to see was pill mills being set up, neighborhoods being decimated. Neighborhoods in this book, Law and Addiction, that we're talking about, that I just released a couple of weeks ago, I talk about towns being referred to as zombie land. I didn't just make that up. There are towns in this country, West Virginia, all over this country, that they refer to as zombie lands, that were little cities that had mom and pop businesses. They were economically viable. They were sustainable. They were prosperous. And all of a sudden, these pharmaceutical companies dump opiate narcotics in their backyard. And what ends up happening, the next thing you know, you got bars on the windows. You have people leaving the town. The entire tax base has disappeared because these opiate pushers took advantage of that city and made it into something that people refer to as zombie land.
Wow.
Now, that's how ugly this is.
Well, folks can learn more about how we begin in some way to mitigate the damage and deal with all the costs that are going to be, that have been laid off on society, for really, I mean, we're talking decades here. Folks can both read your book, Law and Addiction, which is available wherever books are sold and get a sense of it. And, frankly, you know, follow these cases, watch what, Maura Healey is doing up in Massachusetts. Watch what the AG in Nevada is doing. Mike Papantonio, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for your insight.
Thank you, Sam.
Mike Papantonio is the author of the new legal thriller, Law and Addiction. You can pick it up at Amazon, at Barnes & Noble, IndieBound, or wherever fine books are sold. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week that's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Don't forget, check out ROFpodcast.com to support the show.